Chapter 21. Rain started falling on Canaan House early one morning, and it never stopped again. For the first few hours, it was the normal leaden fall of water Harrow Hark had become used to in her time at Canaan House. She found it merely unnerving now, not a killer of peace and sleep. Around midday, a fog began to boil off the saw-toothed waters at the bottom of the tower. It rose up to the lower levels of Canaan and kept rising. The fog was bitterly cold, and the rain stank like engine lubricant and blood. It tasted indescribable. Teacher and the other priests unearthed great spiny patchwork compasses of oilcloth and metal struts, which unfolded at the press of a button, and Harrow Hark and the others were obliged to walk around with them over their heads, even inside the main atrium, where the water leaked through the walls and ceilings. At first, she trusted her hood and veil and let the rain wet her where it would. She was soon forced to acknowledge how difficult it had become to dry clothes. Autus spent half his life wringing out tents of black fabric into the bathroom tub. Harrow was forced in bad grace to consent to him standing over her with one of these umbrella constructions and listen to the hateful arrhythmic plut, 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 plut of water on its waterproof skin. This incidental noise was very difficult for her. It was fertile ground for the false symphony inside her head, and those banging doors and murmurous half-heard ghosts were now joined by a thin background wail, which sounded for all the world like the mewling of a newborn baby. "This has never happened before," teacher complained at meals fretfully, as though they were not lictors in waiting, but instead sympathetic building inspectors. "The rainy season won't be on us for months. It ought to be 10 degrees warmer than it is. I have had to bring in all the herbs and put them under a lamp. And this fog, I guess I might as well die," he concluded, something he now suggested hopefully at least 3 times a day. Harrow found this a suggestion that lacked grace or tact, especially after they found the second round of bodies. There were no witnesses to question when they found the grey, rapid figures of Camilla Hecht and Palamedes Sextus laid on the stained, brushed steel slabs in the mortuary. They had been arranged as though whomever found them had wished to present them scientifically. That they were Sextus and Hecht was at first only educated conjecture. They were wearing their librarian greys, and one had the battered old rapier that had seemed to be all the Sixth House could proffer for this trial, and the other had ink stains on his fingers. Their faces had been obliterated by point-blank gunshots. It was grim. Harrow Hark was surprised by her own tranquility, but concluded she was grateful for it. A strange tomb-like calm had fallen over her when Abigail had first taken her to see the bodies, walking briskly past the sleeper's silent coffin with a lantern held high. Harrow admired her for that, for her lack of tiptoe or hush. Harrow had never seen Sextus or Hecht except from afar, and had formed an impression that was all abbreviations: grey clothes, hushed voices, angles. It was Autus who mourned for them, but Autus was one of the Emperor's natural mourners. His mother had been the same. They'd both loved a funeral, which had been lucky for them, as funerals were one of her house's natural resources. When they brought both facially obliterated corpses upstairs under the direction of Lady Pent, she watched Autus weep stolid, stony-faced tears, which once again turned his sacramental paint into an underwater skull. To properly identify them, Abigail's husband Cavalier scared up the only flesh magician he could find. Finding other magicians at all was becoming difficult. The Day Jewel and Night Rock Tridentarius twins were so elusive that Harrow grew confused even trying to remember when she had last seen them. There was not enough room in the chilly morgue upstairs, and the dropping temperature was not immediately compromising, so they put the faceless bodies out on rubberized sheets in the dining room. It was there the Seventh Cavalier brought his adept. She must have seen them both on that first day, that muggy, sunstruck first day, when teacher had given them the rings and the keys and told them about the monstrous hypersomniac in the basement. But Harrow found she was startled when they arrived. It would have been difficult not to have been. The Cavalier was bronzed and vigorous, an enormous, muscle-bound man in green with a seafoam-coloured kilt and tooled leathers. This well-muscled individual was guiding a wheeled chair down the wide aisles between tables, and in the chair was what appeared to be a dead body, holding a little lacy umbrella of her own to keep off the drips. It was gowned, appropriately, in spindrift white skirts, and, inappropriately, in a little crocheted scarf of pilling white wool. Harrow Hark had known Autus too long not to register the slight curl to his lip and the lack of maudlin suicide in his eyes. He was almost rigid with contempt. She had thought Autus would find contempt too exhausting an emotion to bother with. The ghost, holding the umbrella, had her pale, sugar-brown hair cropped short, its curls gathered into a cap of silky ringlets. There was a gracile delicacy to her, a starved, wasted, childlike mien, and when she gave her umbrella to her cavalier, she actually rose to stand. A fine length of tubing emerged from her nose and was discreetly taped into the collar of her dress. Harrow Hark had never seen its like before. It was a thin, stiffened cylinder of mucous epithelial tissue. "It's great, isn't it?" she said to Harrow, by way of hello. She had a sweet, modulated voice, only a trifle breathy. "It's a pulmonary drain. It goes all the way down to my lungs." "I have never seen such a thing before," admitted Harrow. "You wouldn't have," said the Seventh Necromancer rapturously. "He came up with it when he was 15. It seemed too stupid for Harrow Hark to believe, but there could be no ambiguity in that woman's gesture. Her paper-skinned hand pointed to one of the faceless corpses, the one without a rapier. It oughtn't to have surprised her any more that the relationships between every other scion of the Nine Houses seemed intimate, or incestuous, or familiar, or antipathic. She did not feel left out. She merely felt dislocated, as Abigail said. "Are you sure it's him, Dulcie?" "Give me a minute," said Dulcie, apparently, though who would have let themselves be called Dulcie unless faced with water torture was a question Harrow did not want the universe to answer. "I took a swab from the doorknob. I've got two prints, so if they correlate, that will tell us something." The grossly named Dulcie sat back down in the chair, and her cavalier pushed her alongside one corpse and then the other. Harrow Hark watched her work. She gently grated a bit off the heel of each stiffening hand. She took a minute sliver off each thigh, unbuttoning both sets of trousers without a blush or grimace. She cleaned under the fingernails, just for bacterial phthalgy, you know? And in the end, sighed. "The one on the left's Cam, the one on the right's Pal," she said, proving her desire to saddle the world with diminutives. "Did the sleeper get them?"
"Only by assumption," said Harrow Hark, while Abigail's dolt of a husband said, "I bloody hope so."
"Magnus," Abigail said, a touch disapprovingly.
"Well, if the sleeper didn't, that's two maniacs with an ancient weapon and a love of blowing off faces dear," said Magnus.
"Maniac did not seem apt.
The first death was maniac.
Deuterus was riddled with far more holes than necessary. This had been a simple execution. The effects were grisly. It would be difficult ever to get a clear picture of what Sextus's and Hecht's faces had looked like, as they were now sprayed indiscriminately across the back wall of the mortuary. From what Harrow had been able to reconstruct, and the relative timestamps of the deaths, it looked as if both representatives of the Sixth House had stood quietly with their backs to the wall, about an arm's length apart from each other, and had their faces forcibly removed from very short range. First went one, the second had waited, then the other. Harrow said,
"The projectile exited out the back of the skull, and we haven't been able to dislodge it from the wall. Fragments suggest a similarity. There is reasonable doubt, and then there's unnecessary caution. I say the Sixth were killed by the same entity that killed Deuterus."
"A thesis I agree with," said Autus heavily. "The sleeper, who sleepeth not, perhaps a better name would have been the Waker."
She searched her cavalier thoroughly for any evidence of humour, but found none, as per usual.
"It lies in an impervious coffin. It kills with a legendary weapon. What can we do against such a supernatural assault?"
The dreadfully named Dulcie was stroking a soft, wet lock of very dark hair between thumb and forefinger, quite close to the ruined ear of Camilla Hecht.
"The only thing you can ever do when faced with an enemy too great for yourself," she said, "fight like a trapped animal in a sack."
"I agree," said her bronze statue of a cavalier. "Better that we make the first move. What is impervious? What is coffin?"
Harrow was astounded to hear the older man beside her mutter,
"An adjective and a noun."
"I say we muster all able-bodied cavaliers for an initial assault."
"And die?"
suggested Autus ponderously.
"Better not to die as Deuterus and Sextus and Camilla the Sixth have died," said the man. "If you think of the enemy as unassailable, Shadow Priest, then the battle is lost already."
Then this bronze statue cleared his throat and added,
"I held to the faith of my fallible flesh. Why should I think of the irradiating star?"
Harrow's cavalier swung his head to confront this act of spoken poetry. He looked like a man who had stood on the bailey, beheld the enemy at his gates, and found them manifold and terrible. He stared as though the Seventh Cavalier had revealed himself to be the sleeper, done awful and inadvisable acts with Autus's mother, and compared Matthias Nonius to two shits.
"And that is how you would have your master end,"
said her black swaddled swordsman,
"with her cavalier filled with shot before a box that does not open."
"Interesting hypocrisy from a black cavalier of the Ninth Sepulchre," said his equally tedious opposite. "All right, gentlemen," said Magnus Quinn, with a slightly forced cheer. "Pro Tesselaus, if I'm not wrong. I'm not? Good. Respectfully, I don't agree with either of you. Ninth, you're too good a man to roll over and wait for another death. Seventh, the last time I attacked a box I couldn't open, it was my birthday and my wife had tied the ribbon too tightly. Let's get everyone on side, in as much as that's possible. Duchess Septimus, the Reverend Daughter, Lieutenant Dias, united we stand, divided we fall, or so the saying goes."
"I don't know how much I can do," confessed Dulcie, who was most likely Duchess Septimus, and who had wrinkled her nose when a fat drop of rain had fallen on it.
The gleaming Protesilaus thrust the umbrella over her head.
I didn't really prove myself. There was nothing much to prove on Rhodes. When I came here, I thought it might be my chance to do something."
She finished this rather helpless little speech by playing with a fold on her virginal white skirts. Harrowhark said bluntly,
"Listen to your first instinct. There's a tube in your chest and you can barely walk.
I felt heaps better since I got here, Dulcie said defensively. I've coughed a few times, but it's mainly for show, isn't it, Pro?
Do not mistake the thaw for the spring. Our buds is not yet certain, quoth her cavalier.
Harrowhark deliberately did not watch for the hot flash of murder in her own cavalier's eyes, though it at least leavened his thick, porridgey sadness. It must have been traumatic to see his only cultivated personality trait co-opted by someone who looked like the hero of his very own epics. It was more interesting to look at Abigail Pent, to look at those slender, workaday hands turning over the forearms and elbows of the body that was, apparently, Palamedes Sextus, examining.
No defense wounds, Pent murmured. Just like Judith. I wonder.
The wind had picked up. It suddenly screamed shrilly over the glass-covered, vine-choked roof, bringing bullet sprays of hard rain in its wake. For a moment, Abigail shuddered. Then she straightened up and clapped her hands together as though she led a class of unruly small children.
We're all in this together, she said, which was a typically fifth assumption.
The ninth didn't think anyone was in anything together, or if they were, they all had to disperse as soon as humanly possible to avoid splash damage.
I am beginning to suspect I know where the danger lies, or at least I've got a perfectly baseless assumption, and every scholar knows that this is where you begin. Dulcie, Lady Dulcinea, do you mind if I ask you to get Silas Octokyzeron with us? He's neither to hold nor to bind to me, but he might listen to you.
Fine,
said the woman in the chair, drying her nose carefully with her crochet necktie, so as not to disturb her shunt.
I don't love you for asking, but I won't say that the renowned Abigail Pent asked something of me and I didn't do it, and you've been kind to Cam and Pal. I'll go.
Abigail said, Magnus, will you ask the lieutenant?
Anything for you, even that, he said promptly.
And, Reverend Daughter, if you can, when you can, Coronabeth Tridentarius, and her sister, of course, she added, though Harrowhark thought that addition a bit belated. With the cavalier, again, if you can.
I haven't been able to check. I'll get any leftovers. Ask everyone to leave the facility alone, to come together, and find out whose room doesn't leak, she added, struck by inspiration, so we can put down mattresses as, I tell you for free, we're flooded.
It was left to the cavaliers to transfer the faceless body of Camilla Hecht back into the frozen morgue. Abigail had removed all of the cavalier's effects from her pockets and was brooding over them like a crossword, and the intubated flesh necromancer wheeled herself over to the grisly remains of the skinny sixth boy. He was a perfectly normal sight,
except from the neck up.
Is this how it happens, Lady Pent? She asked soberly.
Abigail picked up a worn leather strap that must have belonged to a clockwork watch face and said gently,
No, it's not. Does it get better than this, do you know?
This did not seem to Harrow like a question that could ever be answered. She did not fully understand it. But the seventh did love questions that were as beautiful as they were unanswerable. This oblique Sally did not get a response from the other woman, who had taken off her glasses to examine a criss-crossed piece of wax and a fragment of darning thread. Harrowhark felt bounden to look at the things they had taken from the Master Warden's pockets. A scrap of soft cloth that you might wipe your glasses with, a pen, a little fold-out examining lens, a crumpled-up piece of flimsy. When the cavaliers came to bear away the warden, less heavy than his cavalier, only Magnus and the seventh, Protesilaus, bore him, with Ortus hovering on the sidelines, the chair-bound girl gave a woeful little sigh.
Oh, goodbye, she called out suddenly,
to the corpse borne aloft.
Goodbye, Palamedes, my first strand. Goodbye, Camilla, my second. One cord was overpowered. Two cords could defend themselves, but three were not broken by the living or the dead.
Harrowhark suddenly felt something in her core, though she did not know precisely what it was. Somehow, in Canaan House, her ability to feel had been blunted, leaving only a sense of dislocated longing, a bizarre yearning as though flipping through the pages of a book for a proverb she remembered but could not find. She focused on what was in her hands, instead of on a stranger's farewell to strangers. The piece of flimsy was rolled up so tightly that it resembled a kind of fat pill. She took off her gloves, and with the edges of her fingernails, bitten to the quick and never much help, she started to prise open one wrinkled corner. She was thoroughly surprised when a deep shadow fell over her, when her cavalier primary laid one black-gloved hand down on her naked ones.
"My Lady Harrowhark," whispered Ortus, "perhaps, maybe you shouldn't, in case."
"You presume overmuch," she snapped.
He withdrew.
"I have often thought so," he said sadly.
By the time she swept into the corridor, the rain driving through the holes in the roof and the walls and lashing in with gusty, bad-smelling sprays, Ortus, three quarters of a step behind her, she had nearly gotten the whole thing open. She opened it, hummocked and humped all over with little rills from being overfolded, and she read, "Him I'll kill quick because she asked me to and because that much he honestly deserves, but you two mummified wizard shits I will burn and burn and burn and burn until there is no trace of you left in the shadow of my long-lost natal son."
"It is a drawing of the letter S," said the deep, solemn voice from over her shoulder,
and she realised she had stopped mid-stride.
"The letter in question is constructed from six short marks stacked vertically 3 by 3. There are two triangles on the top and bottom, which, along with some diagonal strokes, form a calligraphic S."
"Nigonad," said Harrow, without turning, "I did not ask you."
"Three people are dead, my Lady Harrowhark," said her cavalier. "One ranked cohort necromancer, two scions of the enigmatic sixth house, quick in learning and wisdom, if not in martial prowess. Am I to act only on your command when the sleeper comes for me?"
"Were you planning to do anything other than lie down and die?" she said,
waiting for rage, dying for rage, hoping for the simulacrum of rage, if nothing else.
"What do you think you can do, Ortus? Did you have a tactic beyond stopping bullets with your body?"
"It would be within the family character, I agree," said Ortus meditatively. "My father died simply because your mother and father asked him to. He took his own life when your parents handed him the rope, though he had a wife at home and, if he acknowledged it, a son."
Harrow lowered the flimsy, more out of instinct than intent. She found herself turning around to look Ortus full in the face, as best she could with the umbrella over his head, and the hood half plastered to his scalp with rain, despite the oilcloth's best efforts, and his painted skull now a sad melange of alabaster grey and black. She looked at his underslept, roly-poly face, his deep black, drear burr eyes. They were not true black, as she had usually thought. In the shadow, she could finally see a deep, earthy undertone, like the ploughed-up additive ground in the planter fields. His grown-up features were suddenly ancient to her. She wanted to panic, to feel the icy knives of despair.
"You knew," she said. "You knew the whole time that Mortis the Ninth died at their command."
Now Ortis's face changed. It slid a second time into paint-splattered, black-irised, hooded contempt. He looked at her as though she were tedious, He looked at her as though he did not know who she was. His contempt made the doors she heard in her ears slam in an orchestra of unfathomable sound. He looked at her as though she were a squalling infant, as though she had not spoken, but rather opened her mouth and vomited.
"Harrow," he said curtly, "you are not the only person who can add up 2 and 2 and arrive at 4.
Any reply she might have made was aborted by a sudden gust of rain through a broken window. A curtain of murky water splattered through the glass moor. The water carried with it a handful of flashing brown and steel objects, which fell in a tumbled heap on the rotten Canaan House corridor carpet. When they came to rest, she and Autus stared down at a collection of large, rusted pipette needles, the hard plex type, with measurement markings up the side.
"Would you like to know if I can see them also?"
Autus asked humbly, after a long, rain-swept pause.